Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 335 of the Roguecast, recorded June 1st, 2021. A summer emu.
Welcome back, and it is officially summer.
Yeah. It's the June. Sun peeks out every once in a while, yeah. But when it's not raining, it's been weirdly, kind of back and forth.
Yeah.
For like a few weeks
but
now.
Kids are out of school.
Oh, God.
The pandemic is easing off.
I mean, yay. bring them by.
The pandemic is easing off, although we're definitely on the cusp of, like, what do we do about masks and all that stuff.
Yeah. This is probably a good time to say thanks, folks, for hanging in there. And most 99% of the people who come in here don't give us any pushback. We do get some pushback sometimes, though.
Yeah, the 1% that give us pushback are not having a good time.
Yeah. We appreciate people's patience throughout it.
Yep.
And we're looking at mask policy stuff, and we'll figure out where we're going to go from here on out sometime soon.
Yep, we're thinking about it pretty much every day.
Yep. That said. Yeah, it's been nice. There's summer energy is going on.
Yeah.
The store's been pretty hustly and bustly.
Well, and people can go outside again. Last summer was not so great.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a new movie in a theater the other
yeah.
day. That was nuts. We're not going to talk about it this week because I want to wait for y'all to maybe catch it. But
yeah, I have not had a chance yet.
A Quiet Place 2. And it was cool to do it. I noticed, Randy, by the way, that there was like 25 minutes of previews and other sundry things.
Wow.
And at least twice in there was some variant of a promotion, including right before the movie from, was it John Krasinski? How do you say
it? Yeah, John Krasinski.
From the director himself saying, he's like, you know, it's like, if you're here, you know the value of, you know, you, big screen movies, you know, spectacle.
Yeah.
And he's like, you've made the call and we thank you for it. And he was very gracious and thankful, but it's clear that movie theaters are terrified.
Well, it's interesting. I saw a little piece about box office that indicates that The Quiet Place 2 has done really, really well, and it may indicate that things are coming back.
Yeah, I had this feeling like right now, if you go to, I think this is probably the case at most theaters, when you select your seats online, because I think most places have these sort of assigned seating now, it still auto drops a space between you and everybody else.
Yeah.
Like there's still precautions. And all that, but I got the vibe that if they didn't have that theater could have been packed.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you the important question.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not called The Quieter Place?
Oh, that's a good point.
Quiet Place 2, The Quieter Place. And then Quiet Place 3, apparently there's rumors of there's a trilogy. The Quietest Place.
Well, that's a really good point, Randy. I hadn't thought about that, but it's really a good idea.
Yeah.
I think the bigger question is, did you eat popcorn while watching The Quiet Place, interrupting The Quiet Place?
I did that the first movie. I believe I got nachos. And that's actually worse than popcorn. Popcorn, you can kind of let it soften and gum it.
You need to get like their soft pretzel or something.
Nachos is just the crunch.
But I did need some food while I was there because I hadn't eaten that day, and I got a hot dog. Hot dog is safe territory.
Yeah, it's soft.
Yeah.
You mostly gum it.
Oh, but I do go, nom, 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 nom.
Oh, I know. I've heard you eat hot dogs.
Nom, 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 nom.
After every bite.
Yeah. It's so good.
It's so good. Have you guys had these hot dogs?
Nom, 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 nom. So they did ask me to leave. That's the other thing. Is like, I've not seen the movie.
I mean, Dave makes it about like at least 40 minutes into every movie. And that's
why Dave, that's actually why we're not talking about this week. Dave's review is only of the pre-show. Because once he got into the hot dog nomming, it was all over.
I did, as they were dragging me out, I did get my head back in the theater real quick one more time to go, no, 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 no. I think the audience appreciated it.
I think they did, too.
tangent. What else is going
on
this
week? Store news for this week. Among the other things we're talking about is Magic. We're still sorting that out. We don't know if we're going to have Friday Night Magic at some point before, but we do know that in July, which is now about a month and a half away, we will have the Forgotten Realms pre-release. So this will be a lock-in pre-release. It'll be Friday, July 16th. We'll start at 7 o'clock. We'll run until about 10:30. And basically you come in, you play the pre-release. You can play with me and Anna. We're both going to play in it.
Yep.
It should be fun. It's going to be the set. I've been seeing cards leaked.
Yeah.
There's a Tiamat card. Oh. There's a Drizzt card. There's a Beholder card. I think I saw a bunch of cool stuff.
What is that? Is it Xanathar?
Yeah, I think Xanathar might be in there. I've started to see these cards coming out, and they're like the Tiamat is cool. It's like it's a big card, and also it's like when you play it, you can draw and play like five dragons out of your deck.
Oh, that's cool.
So like there's some cool stuff in there. I'm looking forward to it. It seems like maybe a fun thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a Vorpal Sword, I think.
Oh, nice.
I think I saw a Vorpal Sword. Which gives you Death Touch, which is the thing that instantly kills. Anyway,
this nerdy talk, Rand.
This looks super fun. I'm gonna buy Paper Magic for the first time in, I don't know, 30 years.
Yeah.
So that's great for Magic and not for me.
Good on them though.
But anyway. And then Free Comic Book Day is coming up August 14th, which again, still a little worried, but it does seem like we're getting to the point where people may be able to like stand in lines and come in, and we may be able to get to something approximating a normal Free Comic Book
Day. Yeah, sort of more spaced out and stuff like that. But getting closer to it.
And then we'll discover, since we had to order before the pandemic was over, if we have enough comics.
That'll be interesting.
We always have lots of comics. I know we went heavy on the Marvel ones. DC is going to participate, which is kind of a surprise. It should be a good year for Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah, I'm hyped.
Not much news this week, just a couple things. First of all, Aaron Taylor Johnson, a.k.a. Marvel's Quicksilver, has joined the Kraven movie, specifically as Kraven.
Yes.
Which brings us to, there's a Kraven movie.
Yeah. We've talked about this off and on over the years, sort of on the fringes of, is this in production, is it or not? And caught up in the Sony-Marvel, you know, tug-of-war of properties and all that. There was at one point when, I think maybe as far back as when it was just all Sony stuff, they were going to like try and build a Spider-Man, Spider-Verse kind of thing. And I don't mean Spider-Verse like the Spider-Verse movie with Miles.
Not
and all
the good
that.
Version.
I mean, just like they just wanted to do solo movies with all these characters, allies and enemies. So there was like maybe like going to be like Black Cat and Silver Sable.
The Black and Silver, I think, is still in development, which actually I'm for that. I want a Black Cat.
Is that a code thing?
Oh,
Black Cat, Silver Sable. I'm all for that.
Obviously, this is probably happening because Venom did at least solid. I don't know overall.
They were going to do a Sinister Six movie that Drew Goddard was going to do.
Huh.
And that actually fell out, which is too bad because I actually think that would have been good.
Yeah.
But
Kraven's a little bit of an odd one because he's like sometimes he's like not one of like the bigger Spider-Man villains. He is iconic.
Yeah,
I like Kraven.
I do too.
And he has one really stunning story, which I bet they would in some way draw on Kraven's last hunt.
But if you did a Kraven's origin story where he's learning to hunt and getting these powers and stuff, you could do a cool Kraven story. It would certainly be better than that Morbius movie is going to be.
Probably. It could be great. You don't know.
So here's what I'll say, guys.
The Morbius movie actually looked decent.
Here's what I will say. Every time you guys say Venom is good, Sony greenlights another weird project. It's y'all's fault.
So I have a feeling this is all going to spin out of Spider-Man, whatever it's
Far
called.
From Home?
Far From Home or whatever.
No Way Home.
No Way Home.
Or No Way Home. Because we know of all the sort of alternate reality.
It would allow them to merge these.
From what I'm hearing,
the fine writing of Venom merging it with
some of the rumors I'm hearing is like Willem Dafoe reprising Norman Osborn.
But Norman Osborn's dead. He got a glider to the crotch.
But there's an alternate universe, Randy. Maybe it's time displaced, too.
You're saying the glider missed his crotch in this universe?
Can Spider-Man come out to play?
But
don't tell Harry. Also, it missed.
But forming the Sinister Six, but villains from various realities.
Okay, that sounds kind of cool.
Which is kind of an idea, a fun idea.
I hope his Sinister Six is Loki, Deadpool.
I think we know that Alfred Molina's Doc Ock is back.
Yeah, yeah.
And hopefully he will be a more murderous Doc Ock. As opposed to the too friendly portrayed. Yeah, Alfred Molina
sure.
did
it
great.
Just,
it was an odd call to make him like almost a secondary hero by the end of it.
Yeah.
But like that's like what happened in Superior Spider-Man, that was years.
I didn't want his octopus arms to cause him to be a bad guy. I wanted him just to be a kind of crazy scientist bad guy.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question. Do you guys see Kraven as being in any way somebody who you could portray as an anti-hero? I like him best when he's kind of like a cheaty type villain.
He's got his own sort of honor. I can actually see Kraven being someone who could.
I was gonna say I think most people listening know, but he's like an evil big game hunter. He's got some gimmicks and potions and stuff to make himself strong. He he oftentimes uses traps and things like that against Spider-Man.
Is it his son, or was it some version of Kraven that had, like, the reality television show?
That was his son. Was a Ron Zimmerman project.
Yeah. The weird thing is that I could see them mapping that onto this as part of it, where, like, he starts out as a guy who's, like, the kind of, like, overly aggressive version of, like, the Croc Hunter guy. Yeah.
You know, that's what Bendis did with him in Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But he used him as also just kind of a junk. Joke.
Like the
Yeah, I can see this guy being, like, kicked off TV because he was, like, being, like, too aggressive or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, well, you know, I'll show the world. But here's the thing. He's not going to, like, go hunting Spider-Man, which is kind of his big thing in the comics.
Yeah, not in this movie.
Spider-Man... What is the deal? Why don't they have the license to Spider-Man? Why is Spider-Man not even considered as a possibility?
I don't know.
It's weird. Now, like, in some ways it's good because it does leave the MCU stuff feeling a little bit more pristine.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that Tom Holland?
Yeah.
Tom Holland is, to like those movies are technically, like, in that shared universe.
Yeah.
But, like, it's been sort of nebulous. Like, Venom made no reference to the MCU.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anybody know what the how that's playing?
I don't know how that deal's structured. I have a feeling they have to get Marvel's approval to use Spider-Man or something.
They could
I don't
be
know.
Coming to like a point where the next Spider-Man movie crashes everything together, and that's how
I don't
Venom
see it.
Gets into Spider-Man.
Well, right, that's how you that's what you were wondering about, or is yeah, it's like the Sinister Sticks from these multiple realities or something like that.
I don't know. Marvel's been pretty protective of their universe. I can't imagine them letting. Substandard crap like Venom into it.
You know,
you say substandard crap. I say you're wrong.
I know.
Because it is not substandard
crap. I have not actually seen Venom. I'm just poking at you guys.
Join us in the Venom love.
No,
do not join us in the Venom hate.
No, I'm
in it. You've already succumbed to it in the comic.
No, I am maintaining Venom hate.
Come to the Venom movie club.
Nope.
Where we talk about
Deadpool
Tom Hardy
is
doing,
more. Deadpool is more his speed.
Nick, you what you might work at something that you have more of a chance at, like getting Dave to watch Deadpool.
I know that's a lost cause.
So is this.
See, I can break you on movies. I'm going to break you on Army of the Dead. I'm going to break you on Venom.
You might break
down
Army
of the Dead. Randy, who was done with Star Wars. Yeah. I remember Randy, who thought we were knuckleheads for enjoying the Fast and Furious movies.
Yep.
I remember. No,
and then you spent how many dollars on all the Fast and the Furious bundle?
Let's be clear. Just because I enjoy the Fast and Furious movies...
Doesn't mean they're not knuckleheads.
Does not mean you guys weren't knuckleheads or enjoyed the Fast and Furious movies.
That's fair. That's fair.
But now you are a knucklehead.
I'm now a knucklehead as well.
Yeah. And now, with our powers combined...
We are the knucklehead.
We will go to space in Fast 9.
Yes. All right, what else we got?
Anyway, the other story, also of the Why Are They Good God Why, they're doing Joker 2. With Todd Phillips, the original director.
I think this is more of a good God why.
I mean, you know...
it was successful.
Yeah, this movie was, like, mega successful.
Yeah.
Isn't it, like, one of the highest or the highest grossing DC movie?
I think
yeah.
it was.
And,
yeah.
And also, he won an Oscar for his portrayal of
the
Joker.
Yeah, I guess I know why they might remake it.
Yeah.
Not remake, just continue the story.
Yeah, continue it, yeah, duh.
But what do you do with Joker 2? Is it going to be...
I actually see all sorts of ways that they could... there's stuff they could do with it.
Yeah. I watched this movie and I don't remember how it ended.
You know, it's a weird thing. Every once in a while, I will watch a clip of it on YouTube because it's got some watchable scenes.
Well, certainly Joaquin Phoenix is a good actor.
As to exactly how it ended... Oh, I do remember. There's a thing at the institution. Do you remember this? It's like
sort of.
It's like spoiler warning ish. But it's him escaping from the institution.
Does he escape? And okay,
yeah. So there's like a musical sequence, sort of, or like there's music in the playing.
Yeah.
So they're not gonna do anything crazy. Like, they're not gonna bring in Batman or anything. So what would Joker do? Is he just gonna? They can't do like.
Well,
they can't do his famous stories. They can't do Killing Joke. They can't do the big Joker stories.
It's
like,
not
what
the
do?
Kind of movie it is anyway.
Okay, all right.
It's like I wouldn't expect them to really do anything like that. They had him as, like, a guy who was a sort of, like, if you take all its best qualities, it's about a guy who was kind of broken by society, who, in his kind of everything-is-awful sort of way, inadvertently creates this movement, this kind of, you know, that was, I don't know if it was meant to, like, sort of mirror sort of, like, what is it, Wall Street thing?
Occupy?
Occupy Wall Street and things like that, and I guess a little... Black Lives Matter, but the idea, you know, these were rioters and things like that. They were taken by his him killing some scumbags on the
subway.
On the subway, and that kind of got caught up in pushing back against authority, but also in kind of a general nihilism.
So they made the Joker a good guy?
No,
No.
Because it is meant to be kind of creepy and disturbing.
Okay.
But I think that Todd Phillips is just going to go to Martin Scorsese and ask for his undone script of Taxi Driver 2. that is going to be worse.
It's going to be more casino themed, this one.
Yeah.
It's going to be, he's going to base it on The Irishman.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
That way they can release like a 6-hour director's cut.
Irishman 2, Joker 2.
no, I can see how they do it. And I can even see how they make at least solid movie out of it like they did the first one. I think the first one is like, I don't have much love for it overall at all, but it is kind of watchable.
I will not see the second one. I watched the first one on a lark. I rented it at Redbox, but this one.
Because Nick likes to press play.
I do like to press play.
So are you sure, Nick, that you won't watch this
one? Yeah, this one I think I'm done with. I gave it a shot.
What if you find out there's a zombie tiger in it?
Does it mole Joaquin Phoenix?
I mean, it's possible.
Really, the only way.
What's funny is Joaquin Phoenix is not a young Turk anymore.
He's not a spring chicken. He's
not a spring chicken. But I will say, people didn't seem to care. So, more power to him. Joker can be an old man now.
Are chickens born in the spring? Is that what the spring chicken thing came from?
I don't know. I thought chickens were born all the time.
Not like. What is the spring chicken? What is it? Summer? He's not a summer rooster.
Why does the chicken cross the road?
He's not a fall ostrich.
I don't have anything to go with this joke. I don't know what's happening.
A summer emu.
Anyway, we're going to come back in just a second and talk about a giant week of comics. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, June 2nd. It's the biggest DC week we've seen in since the pandemic, honestly. I don't know that we've had this many DC books in a while.
We've talked about this off mic before. It's just that it's weird having DC come out a little bit separate from Marvel, but in some ways it's good because it breaks up our day a little bit and some of the craziness of trying to pull all the books in one day. So.
Yeah, it is easier for us. I think we maybe
say this now, but Marvel will inevitably say, "Oh, books are Friday now, like everything."
No, they have already said they're not going to change that.
I know. I'm just joking around.
Also,
Nick's just trying to fray our nerves.
Retailers are talking about it. Interestingly, Penguin is really good at this.
That's the new distributor from Marvel,
Penguin Random House. Yeah, and it's Lunar has been doing a pretty good job of getting us our DC books. Like we had one day we got them a little late.
But they like pretty much come like clockwork.
Other than that, we get them basically not just a day early. We get them like a week early.
True.
Yeah.
And we're expecting that Penguin may have the same thing. We may start getting our Marvel stuff on like Friday. And then we might be able to sort of pull stuff and have it ready and not have to like scramble quite as much as on a regular basis. Then, of course, we'll be getting Diamond whenever Diamond shows up. So Image, Boom, all that stuff will still be last minute. But
right.
Basically, we may be
able to find a silver lining the same way we did with DC's craziness.
Yes. Yeah.
There's still going to be craziness.
One of their silver linings, though, is that DC, having lost to Dio, and we're pretty sure that's what caused it, they're suddenly, like, firing all cylinders again.
It is a crazy upswing in their overall quality, I think.
And one of the things that I think we've discovered is that James Tynion is, like, their golden boy and is really just killing it. And this week he has a new book, which I will say I think is the best new comic produced this year so far.
I am hard pressed to disagree. Yeah. I mean, you know, of course you got to see where it's going, but like I've seen how his follow through on the Joker stuff, which had a great first issue.
Yep.
His follow through on that has been fantastic.
Yep.
So I have every reason to believe he can pull it off.
Yeah.
Now this is, again, it's not in the DC universe. This is a horror comic.
This is a DC Black Label. It's a horror comic. It's a standalone. What would have been Vertigo if they still had Vertigo.
And the title is?
The title is The Nice House on the Lake.
Oh, that sounds so nice.
It does. It sounds much nicer than Something Is Killing the Children, his other book.
But he does like the long titles. He
does like the long titles.
And I think that's going to probably become kind of a thing for him, which I kind of like.
So before we get into the specific, I would like to real quick run down for people.
Yes.
James Tynion is writing Batman, which is great.
Yes.
The Joker, which is great. Something Is Killing the Children, which is great. Department of Truth, which is great.
Yeah.
Like, this guy's strike rate right now is amazing.
Yeah. And he wrote The Woods.
Which I've not read. But
I've not read either, but I've heard good things.
And I think there's something. Oh, he wrote that Detective Comics run that I liked.
Yep.
Like, this, Tynion has quickly risen, in my estimation, to be one of, like, the go-to people, in the same way that Tom Taylor has.
Yeah.
In the same way that Chip Zdarsky and Jed MacKay are sort of moving up at Marvel.
For me, at DC, he's the best writer, Chris.
Oh, for sure.
He is.
And he does have an issue of Batman this week, and it's another great issue.
Yeah.
But Nice House on the Lake. This is a the pitch is that it's basically a group of people. There's a dozen of them.
Sort of like 20-somethings.
Yeah, mostly 20-somethings.
Yeah,
20,
could 30s. Be 30s, yeah.
They get an email from their friend, I think it's Walter.
Yeah, kind of a slightly odd friend, but a person they've known for years.
They've known for years. And he says, hey, and this is basically during the pandemic, by the way.
Yep. Yeah. This is one of the first comics I saw where people were wearing masks.
And they were taking the temperature as they got in. But basically he says, he's like, hey, I've got this lake house that a friend of my mom said I could borrow for a week this summer. He's like, I've been texting you guys all summer about your summer, so you can't pretend you have something better to do. He's like, if you need help with travel, I'll do that. If you need to be strong-armed, I will do that. He's like, you're going to come.
Yeah.
And it's basically a, like,
getting, and there's, like, pictures of this really amazing-looking lake house.
And then, so these 12 people come together, and they are all been given these titles, like the artist, the writer, the comedian, and they're people that he has known.
He seems eccentric. Like, yes. He's like, I'm going to be, just for kind of my own fun and because I have some neat ideas planned, he's like, you're going to be given these titles of, like, sort of based on who you are, what you do. And he does seem eccentric.
Yeah.
And he's not threatening.
No, he's gathered them all to this place. And I know when I read the pitch, I was thinking, oh, murder mystery or something sort of supernatural weird. I don't want to give away the twist.
Right, we don't want to say what's happening.
But man, does something happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really kind of vibed with me. It felt like sort of like old school Stephen King. You
know, yeah.
All the characters
together.
They've got a really good kind of a quick blurb about you get the point across of each character.
Well, one of the things I liked is that instead of doing like the sort of captions that are like they do in like superhero comics sometimes where they're like Cyclops leader, you know, kind of stiff or whatever,
right,
is they actually had what his own notes on them were.
Yeah.
Which is also a little eerie. You're like, who's taking notes on them? What's happening?
But like the King things, they all feel very real. They all have kind of a voice, and that's very impressive. And
well, yeah, you kind of get to settle in the same way they do. And this is weird. It's like if you've ever seen the original House on Haunted Hill or the remake, there's a little bit of that vibe of like some people getting together and kind of being like, "So what are we here for?"
Right.
Although like they kind of know they're just to hang out and have fun.
Yep.
But obviously he's like kind of like something maybe else might maybe in mind.
It's a
weird creepy cover. There's probably something that's going to happen that's not great.
I feel like everyone should try this, regardless, especially 100%. If you like horror.
Yeah.
But this is a guarantee for me.
It's also it's a masterclass in how to write. We were talking about Tinian. Not only does he do great concepts, but he has good moment to moment. The moment to moment writing is really good.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's also beautiful art by Alvaro Martinez Bueno.
Don't know that artist.
The art is spectacular.
So he has very distinct characters and also like, you know, the whole, you kind of needed to see how nice this place looks.
Yeah.
Like, it really does look very nice.
Yep.
And, like, can get the vibe of, you know what, I don't know, if you, like me, you may not be wealthy. And if you sometimes go and visit a friend who's well off and, like, see their nice place or see some lakeside house and you're like, wow, this is how the other half lives. His art conveys that.
Yeah. Also, Jordi Belair does the colors, and that's another part of it. Like, it is
A-list look.
It's fantastic. So, definitely, everyone should read this.
Yeah.
It is.
For me, it's the prize of the week.
Yeah, for sure. Also coming out this week, DC launching their new horror line, which is a prequel of sorts to the Conjuring movie. The new
not
Conjuring.
The whole horror line, but this one
is the Conjuring: The Lover. It's a 5-issue miniseries. The lead story is, I think, by the writer of the movie, David L. Johnson, McGoldrick, and Rex Ogle. I think they might be people who worked on the movies themselves.
I know that I believe it is meant to ultimately be a sort of prequel or setup in some way to the upcoming movie, right? The Conjuring, the Devil, they may do it.
And it's Friday.
And this is this is sort of a creepy, takes place in 1981 in Connecticut, in college. It's got some really nice creepy stuff in it. It's kind of a short story. But they also have a backup tale by Scott Snyder that is like a Tales from the Artifact Room. So it's one of their, you know, the
oh, yeah, the Warrens.
Yeah, the Warrens.
Yeah, you know, where they have the Annabelle doll and all the other weird stuff.
So this is, it's got that. That is Scott Snyder writing. And I believe the artist
I didn't know Scott Snyder on it, who's no slouch at horror comics.
The artist is Dennis Cohen.
Yep.
So, yeah. So yeah, it's a start for a new horror book.
Yeah, DC. After they also did the Hill House comics like last year,
mm-hmm.
It seems like they're staking out some horror territory, which is pretty cool. Like, I mean, you know, Marvel and DC copy from each other all the time, but like, I don't think Marvel's really been doing much with horror for quite some time. So DC one up on them there.
DC is also DC and Marvel both have like Pride covers and Pride special stuff going this month.
There's a lot of nice Pride covers.
One of them, this is specifically like a Pride miniseries. This is Crush and Lobo, which I feel like we almost should drag Anna in here and make her talk about it. But this is like her favorite book for this week, maybe this month, maybe this year.
I don't know if people necessarily know who Crush is,
right.
But like during a very, very good run from Adam Glass from Supernatural on Teen Titans.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say that right?
Yep.
Adam Glass?
Yep.
He introduced a new character that was Lobo's daughter, and she's cooler than Lobo. She's like a halfway decent person, but she's got troubles.
Yep.
And she's in Pride because she is lesbian.
Yep.
Her
girlfriend is in this.
Her girlfriend is prominently featured in it, as is her wayward piece of shit dad Lobo. And that's like,
yeah,
you know, them maybe coming to some kind of terms or maybe killing each other. Will, you know, no doubt inform some of the story in this. He did, in fact, I think, try and kill her in the Teen Titans main book at one point.
Yep.
So Lobo's edge has not been dulled. He is not like, oh, I got a kid, I'm a dad.
Right, yeah.
I think he's like, I got a kid, I'm going to kill him.
I liked the slice of life aspects of the book, showing Crush in a sort of relationship and how she deals with it. It's like the kind of character tics and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're interesting and make her a character that I'm like, oh, okay.
She also, honestly, in the same way that Lobo does, like, she has a good visual design, and the art is good on this, so.
Yeah.
Batman The Adventures Continue. This is the animated Batman series.
Based on the 90s
yep.
cartoon mm-hmm. that everybody loved.
Still Alan Burnett and Paul Dini, who worked on the cartoon, along with Ty Templeton, who did a lot of the Batman Adventures comics back in the day.
Are they like when it became the new Batman and Robin Adventures or whatever it was?
Mm-hmm.
Are they upgrading to the new designs in this one?
It looks like maybe they are. Because I see Nightwing in here and Zatanna's in here.
Yeah.
But it looks like that visual design. But also they're doing an animated version of the Court of Owls.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they're trying to assassinate or possibly successfully assassinate Mayor Hill.
Yeah, the very recurring politician guy yep. from the show.
Oh, and it's got what's his name? Bunny Vreeland is in this.
Uh-huh.
It's like one of the like Bruce's
animated
like,
supporting characters.
Socialite
girlfriends.
Women in the DDI, well, socialite girlfriends.
And it also has Deadman in it.
Yes, yep. And it has Deadman in it. Yeah.
So yeah, if you're feeling some nostalgia or some love for the old Batman animated series of the 90s, maybe check that out.
Yeah. All right. This week is also the kickoff for the Hellfire Gala, which, okay. I finally broke and read House of X and Powers of X. And though I still have significant issues with it, I had to admit it was pretty good. And now I've become a regular reader of Marauders.
No.
And in so reading, I discovered that the Hellfire Gala thing, they've been planning this, like, since the very beginning. He mentions it early on.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So this, like, feels like a culmination in some ways of what they've been doing. And basically, it starts off this week in Marauders, and then it runs into X-Force and Hellions. You don't have to read all three. In fact, I think that there's a scene in Marauders that takes place in X-Force from a different point of view.
Yep. Now, tell me what a person who is not reading these books, What is the Hellfire Gala?
So the basic pitch of this is that Emma Frost is doing – they used to do Hellfire Galas at the Hellfire Club. It was like a big gathering. Yeah. I believe that when the X-Men were first captured and they did the Dark Phoenix thing –
that was supposed to be one of
them. That was a Hellfire Gala.
Yeah, interesting.
In fact, it may have been called that at the time.
That's it could well have been. That's,
also,
that's interesting.
And also this issue of Marauders reprints the Hellfire.
It reprints an X-Men classic story from like the 80s, yes,
yep.
that did a – that showed a Hellfire Gala. So basically it is their big – it's like a coming out type party. Everybody gets dressed up in fancy costumes, but they're bringing people to Krakoa, and mm-hmm. they give little flowers as like their ID badges.
Yep.
That let them come into Krakoa because mutants usually are the only people who can come.
Okay.
So basically, the Avengers are invited. The Fantastic Four is invited.
Oh, right. It's not just mutants.
The ambassadors of various countries and presidents and this kind of.
But it is movers and shakers.
It's movers and shakers,
which includes people like Doom.
Yeah, they invite Doom. Yeah. So. They basically bring them all to this island for some kind of mysterious new agenda that they announce. Like, we see the after effects, where clearly, like Cap and Reed are like, we don't know about this. What is the plan here? So something big they're going to do, which I think they're going to reveal in about 2 weeks in Planet Size X-Men. Yeah. But the key of this is sort of the first three issues of them showing all these people showing up for a party and all the craziness that goes on behind the scenes. You're trying to like keep security and bring in all these powerful people who may not like one another.
Yep.
It's a lot of
fun.
That's
actually so many powerful people in one place that I would think that there would also be a, hey, this would be a bad place or like a potent place for somebody to bomb or
like
whatever.
Or like an X-Force keep out wayward guests who decide to show up and try to crash the party.
But that is the thing that Krakoa is defended. So I think it is basically a fairly safe place.
Yeah. Yeah, probably if any place was defended, it's probably...
I think one of the more curious aspects of this is there's a scene with my favorite X-Men, Banshee, between he and Emma, who do have a past.
Yeah, I like seeing that, too.
The earliest Generation X.
They ran Generation X.
Yeah, they were like the founders.
And apparently she asked him to do something, and I'm curious as to what they don't reveal.
Yeah.
I'm curious as what that is, because we haven't
say,
seen...
I would do anything for love, but I won't do that.
Of the three issues, I do think that Marauders is the strongest. I think Jerry Duggan has some great moments.
Yeah, I'll look for the meatloaf moment in the other comics of the week.
There's a funny bit here where Doom and Cap are like staring daggers at each other, and Emma comes over and tries to sort of peacemake between them, and basically Doom is something like we didn't he's kind of being miffed at her, and she says, "Mutants are here. We're not going anywhere. You're acting as though we've announced we've conquered Earth." And like that second, the Shire ambassador comes up behind her and says, "On behalf of the Shire Empire, we'd like to conquer mutantdom on conquering your home planet," which gets a laugh out of Doom, and I was like, that's actually kind of a funny reaction.
There's some good moments.
There's some fun moments in it, yeah. It also has some great costume design. They clearly went all in on that.
Yeah. And I'll say this is odd, but it is kind of nice to see X-Men doing something a little different.
Yeah, I think it's good. And then there is a threat in X-Force that ties into the threats that they've been doing in that series. So there is like – they're managing – it's more spy-y than superhero-y. Like they're trying to manage –
But that's what X-Force has been.
That's what they are, yeah.
Yeah, they're Black Ops.
There's not like any big action scenes. There is a brawl that breaks out in the Hellions issue of it. But it's not what I feared it would be, which is a bunch of talking heads the whole time. It's definitely got a little more life to it than that.
Yeah. I mean, same way like X of Swords was it was kind of talky at times, but there was definitely conflict.
Yeah. So far, three issues of this week. I am like, I'm enjoying this. I will probably read all of it.
I'm still in love with Sassy Sinister.
Sassy Sinister is, in fact, it grates on me, but at the same time, it's really
fun.
This
is not a visual medium, but you can see, but you're not here, but sparks are actually flying out of Randy's head.
Yeah. I want to hate it, and I don't. So that's where I am.
The nice art on these fancy costumes. I'm just flipping through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Star Wars War of the Bounty Hunter starts in earnest this week. They had already done like one episode each of the prequel. Now, basically, someone has stolen Han Solo's carbonite body. And Boba Fett is trying to get him, and someone puts a bounty on Boba Fett. And that goes one way. But basically, the person behind it all is a tie-in to the movies. It was a character I did not see coming, but which makes a lot of sense. And
You told me about it, and I was like, that's actually pretty cool. I liked who it was.
This is definitely this is definitely sort of fun crime side of the Star Wars universe.
It's Max
stuff.
Rebo, okay?
Max Rebo.
I thought you were going to say Lobot.
Also in the crossover vein, Marvel is starting an annuals crossover this year. This is something they haven't done in a while. Where basically one story is going to go across multiple books. This one is called Infinite Destinies. And it is about sort of new characters that use the stones for power. So they've already revealed one of those, like Star, the Captain Marvel character. She is powered by the Reality Stone. This one they reveal that a supporting character from Miles Morales, or a supporting villain, is powered by the Space Stone. And I guess they're going to introduce new characters who are powered by each of the stones and do a story throughout that. This is a Iron Man story starting off with him teaming up with Miles Morales, which I've not a team up I'd seen before. It's Iron Man going up against another tech villain. It's written by Jed McKay. It's a good first issue. It's kind of a fun, like, it feels a little bit like a throwback to me.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would recommend anybody who's wanting for sort of like to check out the superheroes of the Marvel Universe doing sort of classic superhero stuff, and also to see some new characters who I'm sure we'll probably have some people speculating on which of these new characters is going to become the new Deadpool or whatever. Trials of Loki. That is a this is a reprint, an $8 reprint. Could have been like a big old trade of a 4-issue Loki series that Roberto Aguirre Sagasa, the guy who did all the Archie and Riverdale and all that stuff, with art by Sebastian Fiormara, who's from Four Eyes, maybe?
Yes, it was Four Eyes.
Yeah.
The dragon thing.
And other stuff as well. But really nice art, and it is basically sort of like pre-Midgard Asgardian myths involving Loki and Thor and all those characters, and taking into the Marvel Universe version. I happen to have read this recently, and I actually thought it was a good Loki story. If you're looking for some Loki in advance of next week's Loki series,
right,
it's a good thing to go to.
The Loki's world, we're just living in it.
That's right.
And they're about to reprint a lot of his other like actual trades, right?
We got the Agent of Asgard, I think.
Yeah.
One of those trades came out this last week.
And that was really good.
Yeah, and that's Al Ewing, I believe.
It is.
Who is doing Immortal Hulk and other stuff. Then there's a bunch of indie stuff. I don't know if you guys read. Did anybody else read Out of Body number one from Aftershock?
I didn't get around to it. No, that's Peter Milligan's one, right?
Yeah, Peter Milligan, who did a bunch of Vertigo stuff.
Shade the Changing Man was one
of the big ones. Yeah, that's the big one. This is a guy. The quick pitch is basically a guy who's in a coma. He can't quite remember what happened to him. We see from his point of view, he's like thinking, and people keep coming into his room. And he was like a psychologist dealing with psilocybin mushrooms, basically.
Uh-huh.
And like, yeah, it's very Milligan-y. He is like in the spirit realm, and there is also a psychic who might be helping him. And then there's someone else who maybe seems like a monster stealing human souls. There's a bunch going on.
Yeah, there's some cool visuals in it too. Like,
yeah,
it is balls trippy from what I can tell, but it also has some of the look of like, sort of like, what was that? Nick, what's the Grant Morrison book that I don't want to even say what this visual is and like ruin it for anybody. But that had art that looked a little bit like that.
You're talking about Nameless?
Nameless, yeah. There's a visual bit of stylization here
that
reminded me of Nameless. And in general, like, I think people who like that sort of Morrison weird, but probably coherently weird, should maybe check it out.
I was pretty pleased with it. It reminds me of like late 90s, early 2000s Vertigo.
Yeah.
It definitely feels like that. Did anyone else read Basilisk?
I did.
I like this.
Yeah, it's. I mean, Colin Bunn has like 9 million ideas that stream through his head every day, because he's good at coming up with fun concepts. But yeah, this
is another horror thing, right?
Yeah,
horror-ish. At least
it's Colin Bunn, Jonas Scharf. Who I don't know the name, but man, the art is gorgeous.
It's like a horror road trip book.
Yeah,
nice. About like
a good structure.
It's like a quartet or
it's like a quintet. Yeah.
Of people who
have some kind of weird powers
and have wrought chaos wherever they go, and about a woman who is on the hunt for them.
Yeah.
So it's just a kind of cool idea. Love the art. The art was gorgeous.
It's beautiful. And it's a Boom Studios book. And this does feel like of a piece with like Something's Killing the Children, that kind of thing.
But Colin Bunn goes in for the one-word titles.
Yes.
Where James Tynion goes in for the sentence titles.
Yes, it's true. this is one of those that, like, if we hadn't had such
James
a strong
Tynion's
week.
James Tynion's A Man is Chasing Me with an Axe and I Need to Run from Him.
Shia LaBeouf?
Yes.
If this had not been such a strong week, this could easily have been like a pick of the week for me.
It was really good.
There's so much good stuff this week. But it is really good. If you're a horror fan or a Colin Bunn fan, you want to give that a shot. Black Mask has a book called Everfrost, which is like a weird Arctic Planet sci-fi book.
Yep.
Another nice art.
Yeah, it looks like it landed somewhere between sort of somewhat more serious sci-fi and like still having some kind of pulp tradition to it.
I don't know any of these names. Like, I don't know any of these artists or writers, but
it was super good art.
Yeah, yeah. Dark Horse has one called The Worst Dudes, which is another weird sci-fi thing about a bad cop hunting down bad people. It's very strange. There's like animal people in it. It is. This is more in the Garth Ennis, Justin or Jimmy Palmiotti vein, I think.
Yeah, the sign I was making for it, and I pulled this like right from their own description, was something like it had a quote that said something like, you know, willfully vulgar or something like that. It definitely had the sound of a raucous Garth Ennis sort of outing
for sure. And then Dark Horse presents another video game tie-in, Apex Legends Overtime, which is another – it's kind of a Fortnite open free-to-play thing Looks like they were doing some fun stuff here. It was like a group.
It's like
an
arena battle kind of game.
Yeah. There's a bunch of people. They're all after the what do you call it? The MacGuffin. They're all after the MacGuffin, which is like a suitcase, and there's a big chase and fight scenes and all that kind of stuff. So
I hope that Jules and Vincent get it.
I hope so, too.
Oh, we happy.
also, Marvel Snapshots gets a hardcover this week, which is – this was all the one-shots that were basically tied into Marvel's
– Yeah, the Kurt Busiek project.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really iconic in the 90s.
Yeah. I really liked all of these.
Yeah, this is a good series. It's got a notable Alex Ross cover that's like kind of got looks like it's a montage of the other covers from the issues. It's really nice looking.
And then other than that, I mean, yeah, like I said, there's a new Batman issue this week. There is a Immortal Hulk, Savage Avengers, some of that stuff. Anything else that was on did I miss anything?
I don't think so.
No, I think that kind of hits all the big stuff.
All right. So that's comics for the week. We're going to come back and we're going to give you a preview of our new podcast, Anna Talks G.I. Joe. We haven't come up with a name. Oh, yeah, we did. We did come up with a name with it.
Did we?
Knowing is half the battle.
Oh, I don't know if I like it.
We'll workshop it.
All right.
But it's a great title, and Dave's a stinky head. All right, we are joined by Anna.
Hi.
And we are going to be doing, we don't have any topics this week, so what we're doing is a little preview of a podcast that may become a separate podcast, or it may just run as a side roadcast, who knows?
Yeah.
But we don't have a title for it, because Dave hates my title, it's super good.
Wait, what is your title?
Title is Knowing is Half the Battle.
It's a good title, I guess I just thought it was on the nose.
I mean,
but we'll consider it.
I mean, I feel like good titles can be on the nose.
Maybe so.
I mean,
maybe
what
so.
Is that Tinian book this week called? Or Something is Killing the Children.
Yeah,
those titles
if we're
doing
with a Tinian title, we should probably call it something like the podcast about G.I. Joe that Anna has not read.
Well, so here's our basic going to be our concept is we've got two devoted G.I. Joe Gen Xers
yep.
here introducing and discussing G.I. Joe, the G.I. Joe comic, not the cartoon.
Yeah, the comic.
Very
the
distinctly
comic book,
Larry
yeah.
Hama's comic with a, I don't know, your age.
I'm 30.
All right.
Are you your Gen Z, right?
I,
or are you the tail end of millennial?
I'm a millennial.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah,
all right.
I'm 30. Randomly.
You
all
right. bring in the queer millennial perspective to this world. And we're gonna like see what happens.
And we're a couple Gen Xers who grew up in the Reagan 80s when pew pew was all cool.
Yeah, like honestly, I was like pretty into the rah rah side of things.
Yeah,
But G.I. Joe, we may discover was a little bit more nuanced. So we have just read the first double sized issue. Rainey and I kind of re-skimmed it. Anna, you've read it for the first time.
Yeah.
First impression?
Yes, I'd like to hear your first impressions.
So my first impression is some of the characters, they feel a little ham-handedly introduced,
uh-huh.
or Hama-handedly introduced.
This podcast is over.
a title, Hama-handedly.
I will say that, like...
He's not going to like that.
I know that a lot of them were being introduced for, like, the purpose of, like, toy marketing.
Yeah.
They needed to check off all the original toy lines.
So like, that's the deal. He actually... Hasbro came to him with the toys.
Yeah.
And they're like... Here are these toys. There's actually the toys that made us, the Netflix show had an episode. Basically, the toys came first. And nobody wanted this assignment. And Larry Hama, who basically had written a few things, he was like, sure, I'll do it. And he basically wrote up they gave him these toys. He created the backstories for them for the toy company.
Oh my god.
And then
all the little file card bios.
Yeah, so I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
There is a panel where they pull up Hawk on the computer
mm-hmm.
and he has like a file card
yeah.
that would be on
the I think they more or less
package.
Used the actual
yeah.
toys file card.
Yeah. So Hama basically had when he was writing this, they would give him like in this first issue, that jetpack, the tank,
yeah.
all that stuff. That's like
gun.
They're like
those
no matter
vehicles.
No matter what else you do in this 22 page comic, or maybe it's like 30.
It was a double sized issue.
Okay,
I
so
think
it's like
might have actually been
like
36 page.
But yeah, in this number of pages, you must introduce these eight characters,
yeah.
these three villains, and these two toys.
Action figure sellable.
Yeah, and so like that structure, he's given that, and then he has to work around it.
Yeah, and I will say, with that in mind, like, there are some, like, real ham-handed things, like,
yeah.
Stalker used his jetpack, or whatever. Yep.
They make sure to use the names. Everybody gets called by their code name, so there's no confusion.
But I will say that I do love that.
Yeah,
like it is cheesy and it feels ham-handed, but like I think that sort of like lends to the appeal of it.
Well, there's kind of a pulp clarity to it.
Yeah,
like where you are doing a little bit of the kind of the fun lineup stuff, and if you happen to be a little like a 8-year-old kid who was into the toys. You're like, that's my guy.
Yeah. And how many times does someone call, like, they never say, like, Snake, or they never just talk to, like, whenever someone talks to Snake Eyes, they say his full name.
This is his full
ass. They're like, what do you think about that, Snake Eyes?
Or that another one where it's, like, arguably more standout is Rock and Roll, where they exclusively call him Rock and Roll. Not Roll, not Rock, not Rocky.
Not his real name.
Not his real fucking name. But they all call, I guess Hawk is his code name. For some reason, I was like, oh, yeah, but Hawk's last name, he just gets to be Hawk, but no, it's not.
Hawk is his code name.
Clayton Abernathy.
He's got, like, a silly name.
I can weirdly remember a lot of their names, and I believe Larry Hama came up with all of those.
That's great. Nobody ever
called him Harry Llama.
Nobody Harry Llama is a different... That's the furry G.I. Joe. Which, by the way, writing down that pitch, nobody would do that. That's my pitch.
But I will say that surprisingly nuanced. I was like, kind of shocked. I was expecting it to be like a little ham-fisted and sort of like very pro-military, but like right off the bat, the issue centers around a whistleblower who's like, the United States effectively coerced me into developing weapons of mass destruction.
Yep, I was going to ask for the plot, and you're kind of getting right into it.
Yeah, and she, of course, gets kidnapped by Cobra, who want her to make more weapons of mass destruction, as if you were concerned about whether or not the masked bad guys with guns were, in fact, bad guys. They have zero qualms about it.
Yep, nope.
And then the United States military must activate the G.I. Joe team and send them to rescue her, not because it's the right thing to do, but because it will make them look even worse in the press than she is currently making.
Yes, there's a great scene. Yes,
specifically point that out.
You see, like, some generals and stuff talking this over.
General Austin and General Flagg.
Yeah.
Two of the big, they're the big wigs in the comic. They recur a lot.
You pointed this out that it was kind of cool to see General Flagg is like the young general, and the older general is like, he's like, you let an old warhorse like me talk, and you already knew what the plan was.
Yeah, which, like, there's some, I guess, I don't want to say self-deprecating, but, like, some, he's poking at the structure of it, which is, like, really interesting. He's like, oh, yeah, you'll make a great politician. You already had the plan, but, yeah, you let me talk.
There's a sort of bemused sort of cynicism that runs throughout the whole series.
Yeah.
Where he is, like, both, like, hey, these guys really are heroes, but, like, also, like, not in the way that people think they are.
Yeah.
And he's like, and yes, they are tools of politicians too. Mm-hmm. It like comes up all the time in the comics, actually. Yep. But like, it also like, it begins with like a cool action sequence. Dr. Burkhart.
She's testifying publicly, like in front of a tribunal.
Yeah, but she's on a train. She's giving a press conference.
She's doing a press conference on the train. And she's on her way to the hearing.
That's right.
And the reporters turn out to be like disguised Cobra agents and the Baroness.
Yep.
And
who's really hot, by the way.
Yeah, the Baroness.
She's super hot for no reason.
She will only get hotter.
Yeah, the Baroness. Baroness is like a cosplay. You will see a Baroness cosplay everywhere. Yeah. Dave, I have my picture taken with at least two different Baronesses. I know you've had and I both had pictures in San Diego with the Baroness.
Yeah.
She was early on, she was a little bit the sort of Nazi woman, women of the SS kind of vibe.
Yes, she was.
And they would go on to, I'm going to say pre sort of like this being like a big out kink, clad her in leather later on.
Yes, yeah.
And, and that would become. I think she's got like just a jumpsuit, I thought.
It's like a skin-tight jumpsuit.
It becomes a very official, like, it becomes the action figure of her when they finally make it.
Yeah.
We'll have, like, a different and more detailed
jumpsuit. Yeah, the original G.I. Joes did not have a Baroness action figure.
That's
because
right.
You didn't make girl action figures in that day.
Yep. Did they not make a Scarlet either?
They did.
Scarlet, you're right. Scarlet was the one exception.
She was the exception.
So,
and
I actually have a question that I'm really curious about. So, was Scarlet active duty? Like, Does G.I. Joe just take place in a world where women were allowed to be on the ground in Vietnam?
I guess that's true. I hadn't even thought about that. She was active duty.
Or are you telling me that Scarlet transitioned at some point?
I don't remember seeing her out in the field when in the flashback episode that shows Snake Eyes' origin.
Well, she was training with him though.
But she was training. But is it possible she worked in some sort of like with intelligence?
Oh, you know what? She was like counterintelligence, so she may have been like
that. Makes sense.
Yeah,
we'll find out more as we get closer to that one. Mm-hmm. But she does get to get a pretty prominent role in this one, and honestly, she gets one. What I always thought was a way cool move. When near the end, when there's a big standoff with Cobra Commander and he's got a gun to somebody's head,
oh, yeah.
she like takes out the shurikens she's got on her on the toys, the glove, which
yeah.
any kid who had it was like, cool, ninja stars, and she chucks it into Cobra Commander's wrist.
So
along the way, so they decide they have to do the rescue mission.
Yeah.
Although Snake Eyes is not on board.
Half of them aren't. Like, nobody wants to go. Snake Eyes is a sociopath. I'm sorry. I know everybody loves Snake Eyes, but that guy sucks.
But what if Scarlet was misinterpreting him and she's just like, wait, he's like, I'm not saying that.
Something else.
He's like, I think we should help her. She's kind. And Scarlet's like, yeah, Snake Eyes says we should fucking shoot her.
We should probably say Snake Eyes is mute. For
Snake
those
Eyes
who
is
don't
mute.
Know. He is the cool, all in, everybody else has some variation, or most of them have some variation of fatigues, and Snake Eyes is all in black, he's got a cool visor sort of thing,
yeah,
and he's the commando of the group, and, like, I will say this, I think you're going to come to enjoy Snake Eyes
more. You're
going to
love Snake Eyes.
In the issues to come, because I think his personality was not fleshed out at this point, and I believe because he was the commando, and he came with, like, a pack of, like, actually, I guess it was ammo, it wasn't explosives.
He had an Uzi, I think he did have a little explosion.
He might have. I think Hama kind of might have been like, it's a man of mystery. He's going to be the hardcore guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's not necessarily how he'll be portrayed later on.
Definitely not.
So I will say that a lot of the characters feel, some of them come right out of the gate, like very like rock and roll, who is like making dumb jokes about songs. And like, he's got a huge beard, which is probably not regulation, I'm assuming.
I guess the G.I. Joe special ops team seems to get some leeway as far as uniform and facial,
facial hair.
But
he's got like a very fleshed out, like very gregarious personality. He's like cracking jokes and stuff. But then you have Baroness, who's like, I hope you're not afraid of heights, Lady Doomsday, because this parachute doesn't come with a barf bag installed. And it's like, what?
But everything she says is mean.
She's so mean.
So it's like, it's not like she's making jokes. She's like just being
shitty.
Mean. Yeah, she's just being a jerk.
By the way, the Baroness will become more nuanced within the next 10 issues.
Yep.
And I will say, she's way better at villainy than Cobra Commander.
Yes.
Like, Cobra Commander spends way too much time twirling his mustache and, like, doing his monologuing at the camera.
Yeah. You know what I think about this? They didn't have a toy of her originally.
Yeah.
I bet they weren't necessarily planning to do it because she was a female character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you will find in these first, say, 20 issues is that a lot of the best characters are actually characters that Hama originates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like Quinn in the next issue and some of the other ones.
Okay.
And I feel like he has more leeway with them. So I think he's like, okay, I'm going to make Cobra Commander a fairly typical ranting big bad, although he's got some good guile in
it. He does, yeah.
He does.
But he's like, I'm going to use Baroness as my sort of like cat's paw character and like have her kind of voice being a little bit more sly about her villainy.
Yeah.
Right.
I will, however, say that the one thing that I did, like, enjoy probably the most out of the entire issue is, like, a single panel early on where Hawk, he says something about...
It's during the briefing, right?
Yeah, it's during the briefing. He's like, we gotta go rescue this chick because, like, I'm sure the media is just making her look way worse than she is. And Short Fuse interjects and he's like, wait a second, Hawk, are you telling me this lady's not a traitor? And he's like, cool it, Short Fuse. Which is like such a, the irony of it is hilarious. It's like,
amazing.
Hawk, surely you know this guy. He's one of your guys.
Codename
like,
new Short Fuse.
I sound stack blower.
Yeah. It's hysterical, but it also is followed by like one of, in my opinion, the things that like makes it like so interestingly nuanced is where he's like, we actually fight to uphold the Constitution. That is our job as soldiers, and that Constitution guarantees the right of any citizen to disagree with the government.
Yeah.
So if you're not on board with that, get the fuck out, because that's not our job.
Yeah.
Get
the fuck out.
That was the gist of it.
Our job is to ensure the rights of these people.
Yeah.
And, like, to get in there, do the job, do it quickly and quietly and as cleanly as possible. That's
right.
What we do.
Fascinated to watch as you see the mixture of kind of idealism, cynicism, and occasional a little bit of jingoism in the book. Duke it out in the issues to come. Now, I want to quick bring up one of the coolest things on just a cool level is that they don't just like have some montage where they go and attack the base.
No.
You see strategy in this, and yeah. like they're like cutting off communications, and don't they even like cut into their their cables?
Yeah, so because
they can send in fake images, or they can cut their radar.
They do, yeah. But when they go in there, they found the cable is surrounded by a lead pipe,
mm-hmm.
and they have to use flash. Their laser guy has to do a quick like burst and like open the pipe up, which is a great way to get flash in there. So like,
yeah,
he found a way to get everybody their moment.
That said, that scene in particular mm-hmm. is one of the instances where it is super heavy-handed.
Yeah,
where
right.
it's like. You might be good at all this sort of stuff, Breaker, but that is clearly exactly
what I wish
what
we had a
is.
Laser trooper with us.
It's time for my laser rifle.
Yeah, honestly, Hama, I think, probably gritted his teeth at that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I imagine
yeah.
he did.
Yeah.
But he always wrote him with a smile.
Also, there's like three or four action scenes. Like, you want to talk about the opposite of decompression in storytelling?
Oh, there's so much going on.
That great opener, there's only like two pages, but it really
yeah,
gets everything across.
Thing,
the stalkers like grabbing the Burkhart, who turns out to be the Baroness.
Yeah.
Them running the tank into the Cobras.
Yeah.
And then the face-off with Cobra and the hostage.
Not only that, they also have their beach landing where the
Cobra yeah.
guys, they know that they're coming in by boat.
Yeah.
There's a village on the island. Did Cobra kill everybody on
Cobra
it?
Cobra killed everybody in the village, and I think...
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, yeah. They move into the village, and they're like, oh my god, Cobra killed everyone here, including the women and children.
Wow!
What the hell? And, like, one of the G.I. Joes is like, we should... bury them? That's like really messed up.
That is crazy for
yeah.
a kid's comic.
I know. I was like, oh my god, this is brutal. And like, he didn't even leave it to implication.
Yeah,
he was
yeah.
like, oh yeah, these guys are assholes.
Yep.
They fucking killed kids.
Yeah.
So, which I mean, I guess if there's anything that's gonna make you as a kid be like, man, Baroness really isn't super hot anymore now, is she? Is
she
like,
did murder
yeah, she murders children.
Well, I'm afraid it works a lot like X-Men comics, which is to say, if you've got a hot villain or something like that,
yep.
they're gonna like end up more nuanced, and you're gonna end up sort of liking him. It's that Darth Vader effect.
Yeah,
it's like I know Destro; he's an arms dealer.
Yeah.
He works with Cobra Commander. He's a terrible person, but he's got like this code of honor, and like more interesting stuff continues to come out about him.
Yeah.
Also, yes, Baroness killed a village full of women and children, but have you seen how she looks in a leather catsuit?
Yes.
I haven't yet, so my dignity is preserved.
I'm looking forward to the Michael Golden cover of that.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess, like, there were a couple things that I, like, specifically took notes of things that I thought were, like, fun little one-liner
yeah.
quotes.
Uh-huh.
Hit us.
So the one that I already talked about, the cool at short fuse.
Yep.
Along with when they are, like, attacking the fort for the first time and they, like, bust in with the tank.
Yeah.
Rock and Roll, like, jumps over it on a motorcycle.
Right. Uh-huh. Like, the motorcycle that has, like, the Gatling gun sidecar.
It has a Gatling gun sidecar.
That
yes.
was also one of the toys they had to work in.
The
okay,
Ram.
Well, that was a cool fucking toy.
Yeah,
so
it
that's
was.
A good
a
thing
great,
they worked that in.
It was a great vehicle.
It was a cool toy.
Yeah. But he jumps in and he shouts, "Get back, Cobra! Rock and roll is here to stay!" Which is, like, so cheesy and fun.
That's fantastic.
If the Cobras didn't know that was his code name,
they're like,
this guy's really into the music.
They're like, he just really likes Hendrix. That's interesting. Similarly, there was one more where it's in that same sequence where they're like coming up on the fort in their vehicles. And someone's like, how do you manage to avoid all of the artillery shells like and swerve out of the way perfectly in time to save our lives and preserve our vehicle? And he's like, well, I'd like to say it's skill and determination, Grand Slam, but mostly it's stark fear and blind luck.
I'm just
fucking terrified and I'm just flooring it.
That's Clutch, right?
Yeah, it's
yeah.
Clutch.
Oh, Clutch. You're going to love and hate Clutch.
Yeah, Clutch is like a misogynist kind of like...
Oh,
you know,
well, fuck that guy.
He's like a chauvinist pig. Actually, he's more like that traditional chauvinist
yeah,
pig
yeah.
of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But kind of charming. And he's not like... It's like when he's around Scarlet, he's like, I think, usually making some remark about like, how about a date?
Yep.
But other than that, they give him pretty good dialogue.
The issue, which I believe is written by Stephen Grant, not Larry Hama, where he goes back home,
yep.
is a good showcase for him. That's... probably a few issues from now.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But yeah, that's, again, Hama, like, he's writing, like, what's supposed to be, like, the, like, super spec ops badass team, and yet he would have these moments where he kind of undermines his own coolness by having them say, I'm just terrified.
Yeah.
Like, and that's kind of cool. It's kind of refreshing.
Yeah.
That was actually what I was going to say, is the reason I liked that so much is that it's not, like, the... like, well, I'm just really good at what I do. And he's like, no, I'm actually legitimately fucking afraid, and it's I'm just doing it by accident.
Yeah, these guys are not John Wick. These are soldiers.
Yeah, which is, like I said, there's a surprising amount of nuance for what I expected to be basically like an action figure tie-in book.
Mm-hmm.
And so, ultimately, the thing that I will say that, like, as I was getting close to the end of the issue, I was, like, starting to sweat because I was like, this is the point where their, like, leftist whistleblower, like, is gonna be like, oh, I was so wrong. The United States should bomb these guys.
Yes. Yeah.
And she, like, literally explicitly says, like, I think 100% that I am still politically justified, but it's nice to know that there are people within the military who aren't shitbags. Which is like, that was quite frankly the best way that I think they could have possibly put it.
Yeah.
It comes off maybe a little fence-sittery, but same time, it is very critical of like the people who are making the decisions with people's lives are the bad ones. Like the people who are like actually on the ground, they are ultimately pawns.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is I'm thinking about this. G.I. Joe debuted in, I think, 1981.
Yeah.
And so this would have been, what, a year into Reagan's
presidency? Year into Reagan's presidency.
But not quite when everybody, I think, was all, like, just so rah-rah about
it. We were still gun-shy about Vietnam.
Yeah, the 70s were still kind of in people's memory at that point. And, like, I think, I mean, you know, it's weird because G.I. Joe in its way created it, like, was, like, part of a rah-rah sort of movement.
Yeah.
But maybe more for the cartoon than all than for the comic, which will continue to have kind of some pushback.
I was going to say, because I did see, like, the odd episode of the cartoon, and I cannot express the difference of tone between this and the cartoon.
Mm-hmm. It's very different.
It's like the difference in tone between that doofy Saturday morning cartoon Watchmen and the actual Watchmen comic.
Yeah, Watchmen Babies.
Yeah. So
I think there's actually a lot of nuance to Watchmen Babies.
The fact that they decided ultimately not to like completely demonize the leftist character and sort of like have her like learn that she was wrong was like really surprising to me and has sort of tentatively made me interested in continuing to do this because I was, as I was reading it, I was like shocked by the nuance, but I was like, there's still time to drop the ball. Like, I mean, hell, even Falcon and Winter Soldier like really dropped the ball towards the end as far as I was concerned, politically speaking.
Yeah.
But this seems to be a little more nuanced than that, which is kind of maybe embarrassing for modern media, but
there's a couple things about Larry Hama. So he studied judo and Japanese archery and Japanese swordsmanship.
Oh.
He planned to become a painter. One of his instructors was Bernie Krigstein.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the greats from EC Comics. Wow.
So he sold his first comics work when he was 16 years old to Castle of Frankenstein.
Huh.
And then after high school, he took a job drawing shoes for catalogs. Then he went into the Army from 1969 to 1971 during the Vietnam War, became a firearms and explosive ordnance expert. And then he came back and began editing the Marvel series, The Nom.
Oh, that was interesting.
Yeah.
By the way, working with Michael Golden on that, who would do covers for G.I. Joe and one or two specials later on.
Yep.
Really super great artist. You know, by the way, I think he also, like, I know Wally Wood had some role in his life, another one of the great artists of all time. And I think he, like, maybe did, like, interned or something under Wally Wood. I know he had some link to him. But from what I've gathered, Larry Hama is like a very he's a driven guy. He's kind of like Miyazaki. He's like no breaks. Like, I mean, you know, I think he can like play and have fun because you'll see it in some of these characters, especially Rock and Roll, by the way.
Yeah.
I think he kind of likes to he can relax, but he does seem like a guy who was working his ass off.
Well, I mean, how many issues of G.I. Joe are there at the moment? Like hundreds?
Well, like he wrote like initially like 140.
He initially wrote 155 issues.
155.
And he's
still currently writing
because
they came back and they're doing G.I. Joe American Hero.
Yeah.
And it is still going.
He was an editor at Marvel.
He was an editor at Marvel and DC.
So here's what I remember hearing is that he was like a tough editor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he especially worked with some of the up and coming people of color. Maybe even like Dwayne McDuffie, Randy.
Entirely possible.
But I might be thinking of like Christopher Priest.
But
I remember hearing a story that he kind of did the pep talks that were along the lines of, hey, and Larry Hama is, what is his nationality?
He is, I believe, Japanese-American.
Japanese-American? Okay, I couldn't quite remember. But I know that he kind of did the, hey, you are going to have to work twice as hard as these white dudes.
Yeah.
And I think, like, he lived that, you know, yeah. he was, like, a driven guy.
Yeah.
I can only stand back in admiration.
He started out as an artist. He got a job at Hollywood Studio.
There we go.
He worked as an inker. He worked at Neil Adams Continuity Associates. He knew Frank Muir, Bernie Wrightson.
So that's interesting. You know what one thing to take from this is that he's a writer on this,
yep.
but he's a writer who knows how artists work.
He began penciling comics for a year and a half, he succeeded Gil Kane on Iron Fist.
Man, this is like one legend after another. It's like Wally Wood, yep. Gil Kane, Neil Adams. These are all like the luminaries of the 60s and 70s.
Worked on a fantasy book, sword and sorcery book, Wolf the Barbarian.
That sounds
funny. And then started as an editor at DC, where he edited Wonder Woman, Mr. Miracle, Super Friends, The Warlord, and Welcome Back, Cotter. He then joined Marvel as editor in 1980. He had a brief acting career in the mid-1970s. Basically, the casting director...
He was in an episode of MASH.
He was in an episode of MASH, The Korean Surgeon, and a Saturday Night Live spoof of Apocalypse Now.
Fascinating.
The casting director of the musical Pacific Overtures called him because an actor friend of his gave her his name when asked if he knew any other Asian actors. He told her he had never acted before, could neither sing nor dance, but instead he agreed to audition and was cast in three roles.
Well, I do think it's hilarious that they were like, do you know any other Asian actors? And apparently they pass his name. And he's like, yeah, I've never acted or anything before.
They're like, do you know any other Asians?
I feel like you maybe dropped the ball on the acting part. But...
So also, this is interesting. G.I. Joe... Every other Marvel movie turned it down. As Jim Shooter, the editor in chief, who gave the other, Hama had recently pitched a Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. spinoff called Fury Force, about a special mission force, and he used that concept as the backstory for G.I. Joe.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. So he wrote the majority of the file cards, and he basically, he said, it had an unexpected female following due to strong female characters such as Cover Girl, Lady J, and Scarlet, and that Scarlet's personality was based upon his wife.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
I want to quick mention one other thing, which is that this is in one of the Marvel reprint collections. It does not include everything that was in the first issue.
Right, yeah.
Yep.
And the reason I think they pulled a backup story, which I'm actually not 100% sure if Hama wrote or if it was one of the small guest bits that were here and there. Like Stephen Grant and some other writers.
Right.
But I believe it was pulled for being wildly racially insensitive, perhaps.
Yes.
As it features like a bunch of like sort of hordes of, I guess, jihadists
yep.
in the Middle East in a story that begins in media res and does have a neat, really neat sequence in it where rock and roll has to push himself harder than he's ever ever had before to like run like, I said 10 miles when off mic earlier, but I think it's like 20 miles or something. Like he has to do this super forced run and to get to the nearby town to call in air support. And it's that part is really cool. But yeah, I think the art and the portrayal of the Middle Eastern characters was just too much for Marvel to reprint that back up.
So G.I. Joe number one, published in 1982, a CGC 9.0 graded version of this.
Yeah.
How much do you guys think it's worth?
$7,000.
I'm going to say at least $6.
It's somewhere between there. It is showing me at $400.
Look, nice. All I'm saying is that I am technically correct. I said at least $6.
You did.
How about a super beat up edition whose cover came off because I read it so much? could I maybe get $5 for it?
I guess possible.
They
yes.
can't have it. I want it. All right. So Anna, would you be down to at least try a few more issues?
Yeah, I'd be down to try a few more issues. Also, to add one last small thing while we're doing the nonfiction stuff part of this, I was actually really curious about the origin of the name G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I did some looking things up. G.I. apparently stands for General Issue,
okay.
Which sort of became... widely used to just refer to your average soldier.
Okay,
replacing the term doughboy, which quite frankly seems simultaneously more and less dehumanizing.
Yeah.
But
between the two, I'd probably have to go with a GI.
Yeah, because at least you can pretend that that's not insulting.
Right, it sounds
cool.
Cool.
It sounds like a code name.
It sounds like a code name.
But then like the term Joe apparently was popularized circa World War II. Based on a radio drama, which was like an anthology series that centered around individual soldiers from various backgrounds as they like worked through a wartime. And the one thing that like unified all of them was that their name was like G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
And this was like in the 40s. And it was part of an initiative to sort of convince people of different backgrounds to enlist, to sort of be like, hey, you, everyman, you too can be G.I. Joe.
Right. He's just a regular guy like too. You. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. So they're a good fella.
Yeah.
That is the origin of the name G.I. Joe. And it apparently has been, like, in, like, use for, like, 70 years.
Nice. Yeah. Well,
some good research.
It'll be fun to talk about issue two, because issue two is where Quinn the Eskimo shows up.
Well, I'm really excited about that. Also, he's named after the Bob Dylan song?
We think so, but I'm not sure. We'll have to look that up.
I'm 100% sure, because Larry Hama is a music guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Also, in the first issue, but not shown here, like, they didn't include it, or maybe it's in the back of this, were just some pinups and things.
Oh, yeah.
And file cards, including one where Breaker is listening to some music while planes bomb, like, some... like, planes are bombing stuff behind him, and he's just jamming out, like, listening to old big headphones.
Yes.
And the song lyrics are floating over him, and I never knew what the song was until a few years ago. It's a Rolling Stones song. I'm going to blank on it right now, but it's a lesser-known Rolling Stones song.
Okay.
Hama is a music. He's a rock and roll guy. I think he was actually maybe a drummer at some point.
Well, I mean, I saw as I just casually flipped through his Wikipedia page that he's been, like, a soldier and like a swordsmanship instructor and a bunch of like crazy shit. So it would not surprise me at all if he was also like, yeah, I was a rock and roll drummer for a little bit.
Yeah. I think he is that guy.
Yeah.
Yes, I am so sure that he did the Quinn thing as like a kind of just like a sort of tongue in cheek bit of wordplay.
Yeah.
One of the other shames of this is that this stuff is not available to read very easily.
Right, there's like the expensive IDW reprint.
There's not even those. I was just looking to see. So there's scattered hardcovers, volumes 4, 5, 6, and 7.
But you know, retro material doesn't have a strong shelf life.
Yeah.
People like are mostly like, you know, if they wanted to read something G.I. Joe, they're going to kind of want it to go ahead and be current and modern military and all of this. And I kind of get it because G.I. Joe was modern when we were reading it.
Yep.
But now it's like retro, like, you know, like all the vehicles and just the tech and stuff. Although it's a little science fiction-y, it still feels like kind of old-timey.
Right.
Wait. Y'all have laser rifles?
We do.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Did you not?
And jetpacks?
Actually, my favorite thing is the cameras that kind of like convert into guns.
Yeah, they just like transformer into guns.
Yeah, that was just something that the Cobra guys had and was an early case where I was like, these Cobra guys are kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like cameras that turn into guns.
Well, it's the first issue. And actually, not even that. It's like the second page of the first issue. I certainly hope that.
Guess I'm with the bad guys
they've
now.
Managed
That's
to.
How I joined a terrorist organization. They have camera guys.
As I look, G.I. Joe has, there's a G.I. Joe Best of Larry Hama hardcover.
Yeah.
That has issues 21, 24, 26, 34, 63, 85, 86, 91, 104, and special missions number 17.
Random. So it just doesn't even have
the like, and like these that we're reading right now are my trade paperback collections that I bought when they were putting these out, that are the G.I. Joe classics.
10 or 15 years ago or so.
And I think there's like 20 volumes.
You have all of them?
I have the entire G.I. Joe run, including special missions, yes.
Oh my God.
So
I'm so excited.
Yeah, so we will be able to read through all of it. But for our listeners, unfortunately, you may have trouble tracking it down. I don't know. I'm curious, like, Comixology might have IDW stuff
on there. Right, I was
going to say,
there may be, like, digital editions of this stuff.
I'm not positive on that. I'm really curious to see. I'm actually looking right now at Comixology to see if they do have they have the new stuff, but I'm not sure that they have the old stuff. So, yeah, a little tricky to come by, but worth seeking out because
see what you can do and read along with us and let us know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, for sure. All right, this was super fun.
Yeah.
Let us close out with our traditional finale.
Will you join us, Anna?
Do I have to?
You have
to.
No. Yes. But you can say it ironically.
You can say it under your breath.
Are you going to hold me at laser rifle point?
These cameras are guns, Anna.
Oh, no.
In the earlier days of our podcast, I would let Randy and Nick do these sort of sincere Yo Joe, and I would be like, Yo Joe, or like, Yo Joe.
Yes.
You can.
Subversive Yo Joeing. By the way, Yo Joe never shows up in the comics, does it?
I think they might later on.
But that's a comic. That's a cartoon
thing.
Yeah.
I remember them mentioning Yojo Cola.
Yojo Cola. That was, I think, his nod to it.
Yeah.
That is like the cola they drink.
Like it's on the base or
the
whatever.
The base, they yeah, among the things that G.I. Joe is, they produce cola for the team.
They don't really ever talk, they don't actually say that. But there is like somehow...
There was a Yojo Cola.
I kind of got the impression it was like generic soda.
I think it was to avoid Coca-Cola branding stuff. Yeah. But yes, you never get the sense that it's great cola.
No, no.
Yeah, I imagine it's probably not.
Yeah. Anyway. All right,
so let's draw it to a close and give out the battle cry. Yojo!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.